Hi, everybody, and welcome to the CIO House View monthly live stream. Today is Thursday, December 5th, 2024. I'm Anthony Pastore, the head of broadcast communications here in the Chief Investment Office. Thank you very much for joining us. Today, I'm joined by my two Chief Investment Office colleagues, Jason Draho, the head of asset allocation, and Kurt Ryman, the head of CIO fixed income and our Election Watch publication. Gentlemen, good to have you here in the studio with me. And got a lot to get to today, which we'll do in just a moment. But in the meantime, to our audience, we always appreciate hearing from you. And what that means is we would love to hear if you have a question. You could send it in by clicking that Ask a Question button right on the website, and that will allow you to engage with us during today's discussion. We're going to be taking those questions and offering them up to Kurt and Jason in just a little while. But in the meantime, we're going to dive right in first and foremost with what's going on in the market. So Jason, the CIO came out with the year ahead outlook, the 2024-2025 outlook. We're calling it the Roaring Twenties, which I know we'll get into more detail on that in a moment. But just kind of giving us like where we are now. What's your view for 2025, according to the House view, according to the year ahead? And what is the latest data from the last few weeks and what the Fed is doing and what the markets are doing kind of indicate how next year is going to look?
So I would classify our year ahead outlook, it's the roaring 20s. And the markets this year, they've been roaring. I'd say our growth outlook, I'd call it benign growth, kind of roaring markets in simple terms.
Right.
And that is kind of the economy this year, a lot of uncertainty of how the economy would land, so to speak. But in terms of the outlook for next year, what we think is a little bit of moderation across the board from growth, inflation, interest rates. So to give you perspective, the economy will likely grow around 2.8% this year, give or take a little bit. Last year was a little bit over 3%. Next year, we think it's going to be like between 2-2.5%. So still a good number, but a little bit further moderation. Likewise, inflation should continue to come down. It's going to be a more gradual descent from the very elevated levels before. But all that sets up the Fed to be able to cut rates, we think, next in a couple of weeks, 25 basis points in December, and then 100 basis points next year at 25 per quarter. If you have that combination, growth that's still over 2%, inflation is coming down, the Fed is cutting rates, that to me is a pretty benign macro environment. That's our expectations for next year. If we think about what we've learned just in the past few weeks in terms of the economy, the economic data continues to surprise to the upside by and large. And a simple way to measure that also is just looking at tracking estimates for how the economy is growing in the fourth quarter. Mm-hmm. The Atlanta Fed puts out a quarterly or like a real-time estimate of like how is the economy growing in that quarter. Based on data through the December 5th, they're estimating the economy is growing in the fourth quarter at 3.3%. So that could change, but for perspective, in early November, like November 1st, that was 2.4%, so almost a full percentage point increase. That's kind of the backdrop. What does it mean for the Fed, and where do we go from here? A lot is going to depend on the jobs data we get for November tomorrow, December 6th, and then on December 11th, we get the November CPI data. If it comes in line with sort of consensus expectations, and we're looking at about 200,000 as consensus for November, then you probably have the Fed cutting. The caveat, I'd say, is that the data we had for October was really noisy because of hurricanes and strikes. Mm-hmm. So the data we're going to get for this November is a bounce back, but it also means it's sort of noisy. So almost we need like 3 months full data, like the full fourth quarter data sense, like what's the real trend? Because it could go this way, and then like maybe sort of settle down. So I think the markets will have a tough time maybe digesting, unless it's really extreme one way or another. But even that could be dismissed as somewhat noisy.
It seems like the markets have already priced in that the Fed's going to cut another 25 basis points at the next meeting next week.
As of the moment, right, like now it's about a 75% chance.
Right, exactly. And we're looking at, by the way, I should have started this with an S&P 500 that for the year so far is up about 28%. So it's been a real banner year for equities.
It's a roaring year.
A roaring, exactly, to coin the title. Thank you, Jason. Kurt, let me bring you in because, the most recent conversations that we were having were really focused on the upcoming election. Now we're past that, and we know that the Trump administration 2.0 will be coming in January. But I think there's been a lot of concern out there from a lot of our investors, advisors, and even friends of mine who are talking about, well, okay, great. So now we know what their agenda is, meaning the Trump administration's agenda, and that includes these tariffs, these big percentage tariffs on some of our most important allies in the import-export communities of Canada, Mexico, China. And the questions keep coming up, well, how is that going to potentially impact the economy next year? Potential inflation moves higher again? I mean, I think it's a lot of speculation, and we won't really know specifically what those tariffs will look like until they're in the White House, and who knows how that's going to all land. But for what we know now, what's the impact potentially on the economy?
Okay, so there is three ways I'd frame it in terms of scenarios for what we could expect. There's we could get a deal, escalate and try to get some sort of a victory, even if it's just symbolic. And that is how I'm thinking about the Canada-Mexico tariff announcement. 25% on two countries that have very tightly intertwined trade networks, but for non-trade issues, striking deals on these sorts of things is very much going to be part of this next administration. The second, though, is universal tariffs. And that's been threatened throughout the campaign. The reason why I think this has a lower probability is that this administration, to Jason's point, is the baton handoff on the economy is pretty good.
Yeah.
And so the, you know, at first do no harm is the principle that I'm thinking about. And universal tariffs would do harm in raising inflation for a period of time and then weighing on the growth outlook. So I think the more likely scenario is selective tariffs. That means that we're going to hear a lot about that. There will be tariffs in 2025. They will be at first announced in terms of trying to reach a deal. They may be announced and implemented on a rising grading scale over time. But we have to compartmentalize. There will be countries where it's escalate to de-escalate, mm-hmm. and that's more the Canada, Mexico, maybe some of our allies, friends, and partners in Europe. And then there's escalate to decouple, and I think that's more the China scenario. So where I would be looking for the tariffs to be implemented first and more aggressively would be towards China, and that's basically picking up, dusting off the books from the prior administration. You've also seen the appointments that we've seen come through. Those have all been indicating that this is going to be an administration that's going to be tough on China.
Right. Yeah, and just to remind everyone, there are tariffs that already exist from Trump, and Biden kept a lot of those. And so, this is not a new thing for all of us just because we're talking about now. It's something that's already been ongoing, but it could potentially change depending on what the new administration decides to do. But on the flip side of that, the other things that were being discussed on Trump's campaign trail were maybe possibly a benefit to certain parts of the economy, talking about lowering corporate taxes. Personal tax exemptions might be changing and maybe looking better for certain people. What's the impact potentially there?
Yeah, I think the initial market reaction to the Trump win was focused on the possibility of deregulation mm-hmm. and not seeing taxes rise. I think that's a pretty fair assessment. We will most likely get a full extension of the personal tax cuts, despite the fact that these will raise the deficit. It's just a question of how much is Congress willing to allow deficits to grow. They'll be looking for offsets, and that's where deregulation comes in. Is there opportunity for some modest spending cuts or maybe some other areas of raising revenue in order to close the gap some? But what's important about this is that we not assume that this is going to be necessarily stimulative for the economy. Mm-hmm. When you're paying the same tax rate in 2026 that you paid in 2025, it's not a boost to your disposable income. One other area that does get talked about quite a bit is, as you mentioned, corporate tax cuts. I think that's a bridge too far. We're already talking about adding to the deficit. If we were to extend tax cuts, further tax cuts to corporations, that would make the deficit impact greater. There has been some talk about feeding through the income from tariffs to be able to offset maybe the opportunity to cut corporate tax rates. I think that's also legislatively very difficult, if not also problematic from a legal standpoint. But anyway, that's being talked about, so I thought I'd mention it.
Yeah.
Right now, corporate taxes, we don't think they're going to get cut, but it's certainly something that the market is looking and trying to factor in as a possibility.
And let's not forget, even going into this red sweep, there's a very slim majority that the Republicans have in both chambers of Congress. Yeah. So anything that's legislative and needs to be voted on, it's still going to be tough.
That's correct. With the three appointments that came from the House into the cabinet and elsewhere, that leaves the Republicans with a one-seat majority.
That's right.
And three seats in the Senate. So they have to effectively get everybody on board. And as we saw in the last Congress or the current Congress, that's not always possible. So
I think anybody out there who's a part of the American public and even our foreign friends and colleagues understand that it's not that easy to get things voted on by your entire party anywhere in Washington, D.C. So, yeah, it'll be a little bit of a struggle when it comes to legislation. Jason, when you talked about something called the Trump put, especially when it relates to looking at Treasury yields, which right now we're looking at a 10-year that's around 4.20, a 2-year I think is around 4.10 the last I looked. But you look at that as a restriction, you said. Talk about that and what that is.
So first, let's kind of define what I mean by puts.
Yeah.
And put is just in terms of financial security. It's the idea of you can buy something that basically caps your downside. You can buy a put option on the S&P 500 that limits how much you can go down. In financial markets, we've talked for decades about the idea of a Fed put. The markets go down, then suddenly too much, the Fed starts to react because they're worried, say, about growth concerns. What we learned during the first Trump administration is that there was effectively a Trump put out there because he follows the stock market closely. I think that's pretty widely documented. Like, he would tweet about it. And if the market falls too much as a signal of like not being happy with his policies, then suddenly that would cause a change of course. So that's so that we know that the Trump put essentially for equity markets. What I would suggest is there might be a Trump put also for the Treasury markets, meaning that he actually can't have interest rates go higher or bond prices go lower because that would be negative for the economy. And it's important to think about today versus where we were 8 years ago. On election day in 2016, the inflation rate CPI was 1.6%. Now it's 2.6%, and other measures are even higher. The 10-year Treasury yield was 1.85% back in 2016. This election cycle, it was 4.28%. So all this means, why I think there's a Trump put, is that you don't want rates to go much higher because that could be a drag on the housing market, could be a drag on the stock market, the economy overall. Which means from a policy perspective, the markets will kind of signal if you do things that are too inflationary or things that would expand the deficit, we're worried about big deficits going forward, interest rates will likely rise. That could be bad for the markets overall. So to me, Trump, knowing that that's bad, would say, well, we can only go so far before risking essentially rates kind of skyrocketing. So essentially, there's a Trump put, I think, for treasuries, which means there's a sort of limit how high rates can go, which means there's a limit on what they can do, whether it's maybe tariffs, whether it's on fiscal policy, that could be inflationary. Like that's a conjecture. We'll see how this plays out. But I think that's something that is, in some sense, if you want to have a good financial markets, then you have to also make sure rates don't go higher. It means you have to have a Trump put for treasuries as well.
You would almost think that, since Trump is, like you said, he's somebody who follows the markets and, he's wants to make sure his net worth stays where it is, that he would look at what you just talked about and look at the tariffs that he's potentially trying to implement and say, oh, that's inflationary. Maybe that's not such a great idea. So it'll be interesting to see how, the quote unquote threats to these foreign countries versus what the reality will be when he looks at the entire picture will dictate how he may or may not deal with
this. Well, I assume he reads my research, so of course he knows about this.
Of course he does, right? You can send it directly to his desk. As a follow-up, Jason, something that's discussed, of course, in the Year Ahead report are the equity markets, which we just indicated they're up about. The S&P is up 28% for the year so far. And the base case is that there's still room to go. So talk about the reasoning why we think that equities still have some potential travel room here to go higher.
Well, I go back to my first answer regarding the economy, sort of benign growth. If you have these conditions of growth being good, inflation coming down, and the Fed cutting rates, all equal, that is a conducive environment for equities to go higher. So that's, and to be clear, like our price target for the S&P 500 at the end of 25 is 6,600. That's roughly about a 10% upside in price from where the current level around 6,000. You add, dividends to that, you're looking at about an 11 to 12% total return over 12 months, which is in line roughly with historical averages. And given the macro conditions, again, that should be sort of favorable for that. Now, there are concerns right now in the market about things getting a little bit frothy.
Yeah.
And I would, there's definitely pockets of froth. A simple thing that's interesting is that the conference board does surveys of consumer confidence. They also ask a question, do you expect the stock market to go up? In the most recent one, it was the highest it's ever been, the percentage of people saying yes, higher than the dot-com bubble. You have to go back to the mid-80s. So things like that kind of raise the concerns. Our market's getting a little bit too exuberant. My kind of take is that that's not really the case if you look at sort of broad-based. Things like crypto, the Bitcoin is now over 100,000. There's some pockets of that. But typically to get really kind of frothy conditions, you need a lot of confidence about the state of the economy. And consumer and business sentiment measures are actually, well below kind of prior peaks. So that suggests there's still some concern about the economy. And we've talked about, tariff risks, so it's not at all clear. You're not seeing things like M&A or IPOs that tend to be really sort of signs of exuberance. They're actually relatively muted. And you actually don't see a lot of what I would call like narratives, as people telling stories about like this time is different. you know, we can value companies on these metrics, not cash flows. You're not seeing that. So to me, we're not there yet. It could happen. I'm not saying it will happen. But to me, it's much more like 1996 when Alan Greenspan first uttered irrational exuberance. We had another 3.5 years to go before we actually kind of topped off. And I think we're much closer to that than we are to like a 1990s, you know, 99, 2000.
Well, how are valuations right now in the equity markets? It seems like obviously you talk about these pockets of opportunity, but it seems like valuations are pretty healthy.
So, well, or, you know, elevated. I mean, by most measures, you could say that equities are certainly above long-term averages. The issue about valuations is that they matter in the long term. They don't matter necessarily in the short term, meaning just the predictability, like just pure statistics of like, what's the relationship between your starting PE Gen 1 versus your total year return? It's basically zero.
Right.
So you need other factors, you know, policy changes, concerns about recession, something that would cause the, you know, the valuation to roll over. Again, those are risks, but without it, you know, the valuations could stay where they are. So our, you know, thesis is really just predicated on earnings growth being good next year to get that kind of return I've talked about before.
Yeah, great. And Kurt, on the fixed income side, if we do continue to see the Fed cut rates, as is our house view right now, 100 basis points, 2025, another 25 perhaps next week, what does that say for the opportunities within the fixed income markets next year?
They're strong. Our view is that the Fed will cut rates more than the market expects, and that'll have a nice impact on the front to intermediate part of the curve. So we like the five-year sector. Going a little bit further out, our 10-year forecast next year is to go from current levels of around 4.20 down to 4%. So it's not a huge lift, but it's better than the other direction.
Right.
As Jason was mentioning, there is that idea of a Trump put, if you will, in bond yields. But we can't rule out the possibility that the bonds, that the 10-year moves back to 4.75% or 5%. And that's the reason why we don't go too far out the duration spectrum, is that there is that, I don't know if I want to call it asymmetric risk, but there is that risk that bond yields rise out the back end. So we like moving out of cash and into the five-year. Taking on any more interest rate risk to us seems like it's a bridge too far just now. And then if you think about some of the other opportunities, if your goal is to pick up income, don't do it by going further out the interest rate spectrum.
Right.
Go into quality bonds in the corporate space, or maybe look to opportunities in MBS. Parts of the market have been weighed down by volatility being high. That volatility has come back down. Spreads have narrowed. That there's still room for that to even for not in the corporate space where spreads are very tight, but in mortgage backs there still is. So there are opportunities within the bond market next year, more for just general, let's call it income. Not for spread appreciation, but hey, that we're talking about plus 4%. We weren't there 4 or 8 years ago, so that's a good thing.
Right, but put that cash to work now if you happen to still be sitting in it.
Yeah,
and I know that you and the team recently changed your call or updated your call. And now you really like that five-year part of the curve for the reasons that you were just saying. You don't want to go out too long, but 5 years seems to be a little bit of a sweet spot.
That's right.
Yeah. Great. Thanks, Kurt. We're starting to get questions in. I just remind all of you watching, if you do have a question, click the Ask a Question button on your screen. We'll get to some of the audience questions here in a moment. Jason, I wanted to go back to you, specifically looking at the equity side. Are there any particular areas within the space, sector-wise, where you would recommend clients and investors be kind of looking for some of those opportunities you were talking about?
Well, one of the sectors we like, the one that's most attractive to us, is the tech sector.
Right.
It does tie into kind of like one of our key messages, which is, you know, seize the AI opportunity. You know, a lot of questions and concerns, like, you know, is the AI opportunity kind of run its course? Is it, you know, is it a bubble or not? When we look at the sort of the fundamentals, we just think there's continued runway for the amount of investment that will have to take place, particularly like what we classify as the infrastructure layer, which is like literally building the data centers, using the micro, the processors, the semiconductors, to provide the foundation to be able to run these models, which ultimately will lead to applications later on. The investment that some of the big mega cap tech companies are doing in this space is just, it's enormous. We were talking about $165 billion last year, $225 billion this year, and it could be $265 billion next year. So there's just, we think, kind of more clear kind of runway for the tech sector in this AI theme. Another thing that we like is more kind of a thematic idea is to invest in power and resources. So this kind of a dovetails to some extent the AI theme.
Yeah, it's like the AI adjacent theme.
It's sort of an AI adjacent plus other things.
Yeah.
Because, like, to run these data centers, it's been well documented this year, like, just big demands for energy, these companies are actually going out and getting their own direct power sources. But you add on to that, like, further electrification of, like, electric vehicles, mm-hmm. you know, in the U.S., but globally, just sort of general electrification sort of the economy. So there's a variety of companies that we think can sort of be positioned for that thematically against for power and the resources to go into building that power. So those are a couple of ideas that, aside from saying more to go in equities in general, just sort of having equity exposure, specific opportunities that we like in the equity markets.
What about small and mid caps?
I'd say our preference right now would be more towards large caps.
Large cap. You know,
it isn't necessarily strong large versus small call. Mm-hmm. You know, we've seen for the past year a couple of times where smalls had a good run, but I think for small caps, from the experience of the past year or two, is that you need not just good or benign growth, you need almost Goldilocks, meaning growth is, if anything, accelerating, inflation is still coming down, and the Fed is actively cutting, and investors really have confidence to truly kind of broaden out in a sustainable way. That could happen, but I think as our base case, I'd say just having broader exposure and then some of these thematic ideas is, I think, offers a better sort of risk-reward trade-off, all things considered.
Terrific. Thanks, Jason. All right, so let's get to some questions. First one coming in here is asking, and Jason, since we're talking about equities, I'll position this to you, is saying, you know, CIO's view is that S&P earnings growth next year will be around 8%. And the question is, why is it lower than what the rest of the street is saying? Is it the case that it's lower than what the street is saying? I don't have that data in front of me, but...
So I wouldn't say it is, but there's a couple of important caveats when you think about these numbers.
Yeah.
When you see our forecast, this is a sort of top-down view of the markets overall, and kind of based on sort of analysis of the markets, we think the S&P 500 earnings will grow 8%. Mm-hmm. A lot of sometimes numbers you see for Wall Street in general for earnings are more bottoms up. Mm-hmm. So you take individual analysts making forecasts for individual stocks, you aggregate that. Now, what's known historically is that bottoms up assessment often ends up being too optimistic and it gets revised down. Like every single quarter, the guidance tends to go lower and then the companies beat. There's just this kind of whole kind of, you know, game that companies play with Wall Street. So when you see certain like those numbers, they could be bottoms up, which again, you almost have to air cut it by about 3% to get what the top-down strategists are saying. I think that most of what I've seen in forecasts for next year would be more consistent with our 8%. The other caveat is that it really kind of depends on what are people assuming regarding tax cuts and tariffs, and particularly tariffs. You know, depending on what you assume, it could impact corporate earnings in different degrees. So I think if you could see just variation, not because of an economic assumption is that much different or the fundamentals that much different, but they're just assuming something different on, you know, say on tariffs, for example, or regulation changes next year. So that's an important caveat. And mm-hmm. as Kurt's already outlined, like there's a wide range of outcomes of how these things could play out. Depending on where you want to go, you're going to get some variation. And, you know, as we move into next year, we'll get better clarity of what that policies are going to be and then sort of refine it. But I think that is a, based on the fundamental benign outlook, that is sort of consistent with that.
Great. Excellent. Another question coming in asking about currencies. Kurt, I don't know if you want to tackle this one, and asking, where does CIO see, you know, opportunities in investing in currencies? It seems like now the U.S. dollar might be a little top-heavy, maybe a little overvalued. But what does 2025 look like when it comes to the currency market?
It's overvalued. It's been overvalued. Tariffs and other policies like that will make it even more overvalued. So it's one of those tricky moments where you can see something that's strong become stronger. The administration has been speaking quite vocally about a weaker dollar, and I think it understands the inconsistency between some of the policies that they're promoting and their preference for the dollar. I think Scott Bessent at Treasury is fully aware of this. They're not going to get a weaker dollar as they pursue an aggressive, muscular tariff strategy. So our view is that over the longer-ish term, say over the next year, we do expect the dollar to be weaker than its current level, and we would sell into strength, but we recognize that the dollar could, in the near term, become stronger because of the policies that the administration is looking to put in place.
Right. As you were speaking, we just got a question talking about Scott Bessent, who you just dropped a name there for a second. And the question is, what could his nomination as Treasury Secretary mean for the Fed policy next year? Could it affect it at all? I mean, technically, the Fed, as we know, is supposed to be sitting apart from the government.
Bessent has been historically critical of the Powell Fed. Mm-hmm. In Treasury, it's...
Trump has too, but
Bessent in Treasury will steer clear of commenting on Fed policy and sort of, you know, trying to intervene. That would be that would be a risky proposition when your role is to ensure adequate and safe funding for the government. Talking about or commenting even negatively or positively about what the Fed is doing. So likely to steer clear. That's also consistent with our now long-running message that in a Trump administration, we think Fed independence is still secure, that Jay Powell retains his chairmanship through May of 2026. But also the market reaction to Scott Bessent's appointment at Treasury was an indication that the market was quite comfortable, and comfortable because the administration took the time to vet someone who was not just loyal to the administration's agenda, but was also well known and well respected on Wall Street and within the Beltway. So we had something of a, you know, kind of sell the rumor, buy the fact in the bond market around Trump's election. And that buy the fact, meaning yields falling, was the Bessent appointment. And I think it's that idea of not moderating the president's policies, but carrying it out in a methodical way and being a trusted voice.
Excellent. Thanks, Kurt.
Can I just add one thing?
Yeah, please, Jason.
I agree with everything that Kurt said, but that won't prevent Trump necessarily from tweeting out his displeasure if the Fed's not cutting interest rates. So there's, I think, everything that Kurt said, I think that's how Bessent would approach it. But the Fed meets, I think, beginning of February. If they don't cut rates then, wouldn't be surprised to see a tweet of, like, the Fed is not doing the
job. I feel like I've seen language like legislation by tweet when it comes to, and it's not anything different than we saw in 2016 to 2020 when he was sitting in the White House. So I would expect more of the same. And I think the American people would expect that as well. This is an interesting question, and I know we're not in the business of giving advice on crypto, particularly Bitcoin, but we have seen Bitcoin surging since Trump, since it was announced that Trump won the election, and it's above $100,000 today. Is there any outlook on the crypto market? I mean, I know there's crypto ETFs out there that certain people can get into. Obviously, there's a very high minimum for a lot of these ETFs, but any thoughts that you'd share?
So, you know, we don't officially forecast, you know, Bitcoin or any sort of cryptocurrency in terms of what their price could do.
Exactly.
And if I saw anyone make a forecast, I'd also take it with a massive grain of salt, because how do you value something that doesn't generate kind of cash flows over time? Like a stock, a bond, these things, like, you know, there's cash flows, you can discount it. At least there's a valuation framework. So it really comes down to, you know, almost as much as market sentiment, conviction of among a variety of different types of investors, psychology more than anything else, which is incredibly difficult to predict. We know Bitcoin has had massive swings just over the past few years. It's on an upswing. You know, this time next year, we could be, you know, after the market sort of disappointed because there's not enough crypto-friendly legislation, it could be down to, you know, 40,000. So everything's on the table.
Of course.
The one thing I would just say about it is you treat it just as a general asset class, like take off the name Bitcoin. It is incredibly volatile. You know, I think it's a high beta, high volatility, non-profitable tech stock, which is something that, you know, you have to be very careful when you sort of invest in those things. It could do really well, but it could also, you know, go, you know, very low.
Great. Thanks, Jason. And one last question. This is for me, and I mean, I'll ask to you, Kurt, I guess, or Jason, feel free to jump in. In the year ahead, there's also talk of precious metals. Gold has had an incredibly strong year. It trades like the S&P 500. It's up also about 28% for the year. But there's talk of, there's lithium, there's copper, there's other metals that are out there. What's our thought on precious metals in the 2025? And does gold still have room to go here?
Gold does. It's primarily around some of the changes that central banks are making in their reserve holdings away from, and not mass sales, but away from dollar holdings and towards gold as a, in their minds, probably a more trusted holding after the decision to expropriate Russian central bank assets after the invasion of Ukraine. So that's ongoing and likely to still benefit gold in the next administration. We can also add to it the geopolitical and tariff risks that would likely also support it. But any other thoughts on...
Yeah, Jason, anything to add to that?
No, I think, well, on, you know, on the gold piece, kind of agree with that. I just go back to what I mentioned on equities in terms of the kind of the investment power and resources. There's clearly some areas, like kind of some thought that before you go green, you have to go brown, like investing in copper and things of that sort. So there's definitely kind of more broad-based opportunities that are tied to some of these other thematic ideas. And either you can buy stocks or there's opportunities within the commodity space directly, like in you know, and the minerals that will get you some of that exposure.
Excellent. Great. Great conversation, gentlemen. Thanks very much. Always good to be with both of you. Good to see you.
Good.
Great. Thank you to our audience as well. Thank you for the very thoughtful questions that you sent in. We always appreciate getting those, as we always say. And thank you for spending time with us today. Don't forget our next CIO Monthly live stream will take place right after the new year, Thursday, January 2nd at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And until then, we, of course, will keep you posted with all of the latest views through our House View publications, our CIO alerts, also our multimedia content videos like this, and as well as podcasts, etc. You could find those all at ubs.com/views. Navigate lots of insights from the CIO and the firm, from our colleagues and our best partners. And for more on the CIO's outlook for 2025, the website's right there on your screen, ubs.com/CIO-year-ahead. And as always, we continue to encourage you to continue this conversation with your financial advisor. They are certainly the best person to talk to if you have questions after today's conversation. In the meantime, we want to wish you all a wonderful holiday season, a happy new year. We'll see you in 2025. Thanks for joining us. Have a great rest of your day, everybody. From New York City, I'm Anthony Pastore. Thanks very much.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.